From the studios of WMUA 91.1 in Amherst, Massachusetts, this is Writer's Voice, where the conversation goes deeper. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.
The book is all about the three things you should never talk about in polite conversation. First, the religion, then the politics, his anti-slavery politics, but then there's sex.
That's historian Debbie Applegate. We'll be spending most of the hour talking with her about Henry Ward Beecher, the 19th century evangelist. And later, we'll hear an excerpt from an interview with Marge Piercy about her novel, Sex Wars, which also talks about Beecher. Stay with us. In today's America, evangelical Christianity is associated with a right-wing brand of conservative politics that the topic of our show today, 19th century evangelical preacher Henry Ward Beecher, would find surprising, if not repellent. He preached a gospel of love, not retribution, was a passionate opponent of slavery, and advocated a natural marriage of reason and feeling that America has seemed to forget is possible. Along with his equally famous sister, Harriet Beecher Stowe, he was part of an abolition movement that freed the slaves and helped create a new progressive political party, the Republican Party. Our guest, Debbie Applegate, started studying Henry Beecher as an 18-year-old undergraduate at Amherst College. She went on to write her doctoral thesis about him and then spent another 7 years writing her acclaimed biography, The Most Famous Man in America. Writer's Voice Associate Producer Michael Pollitt joined me on the interview. Debbie Applegate, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'm joined here also by my co-host and associate producer, Michael Pollitt.
Hello.
All right. Well, Michael, why don't you start out?
All right. Debbie Applegate, why the title, The Most Famous Man in America?
It's a great question. Because, in fact, Henry Ward Beecher was, for 30 years, the most famous man in America. We could say maybe Abraham Lincoln was more famous, but really only for about 5 or 6 years, and then he was a martyr, and then it's a whole different kind of fame once you're a saint, isn't it? Same thing with, say, Ralph Waldo Emerson. A lot of people knew his name, but Henry Ward Beecher was kind of a combination of Billy Graham, Bill Clinton, and Paris Hilton all rolled up into one. He was famous for religion, for politics, for being a cultural gadfly in a million different ways, and also for a big scandal. But now, he's probably best remembered as the brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe, the most famous woman of the 19th century in the English-speaking world, famous nowadays for having written Uncle Tom's Cabin, the great anti-slavery novel.
You just mentioned Harriet Beecher Stowe. How did it come to be that a brother and a sister were probably the two most famous people in America in their time?
Well, you know, it turns out there were lots of Beechers. When I first started writing this, I was only an 18-year-old college student. When I first discovered Henry, and I was doing a little exhibit in the Amherst College Library in my student job, and the exhibit was on notorious alumni of the college. And apparently it was notorious at some point, but I had never heard of him. But as soon as I started looking him up, it turns out the Beecher clan, was as important as any of the big 19th century clans, like the James family, the Adams family, even, say, the Kennedys, or any of those big clans. They were as influential or more than most. His father, Lyman Beecher, was one of the last of the great Puritan ministers in America, and he was filled with both worldly and spiritual ambition. And he had 12 children, 11 of whom lived to adulthood, and almost all of them became important public figures, including his two sisters, not just Harriet, whose fame, literally, she was the Dan Brown of her day. That's how popular, that's how well-read she was.
Brown of the...
Yes, of the Da Vinci Code. Right. That's literally, if you would go anywhere on the train, a carriage. Anywhere you looked, there were people reading Uncle Tom's Cabin. It made, the Harry Potter phenomenon, perhaps, is almost the best way to think of it, because they literally had little tchotchkes and little, picture, everything. You could buy merchandise to go along with it. Really huge. But it wasn't just Harriet. His other sister, Catherine Beecher, was pretty much the Martha Stewart of her day. She basically invented home economics, was a famous writer and activist in many different fields. And his brothers, who all went on to national prominence as theologians or as preachers, all seven of the Beecher boys went into the ministry, whether they wanted to or not, pushed by their father. So it's one of those moments where you had a charismatic, powerful father who somehow pushed all of his kids to greatness, but also to great depths in some ways.
Tell us a little bit about Lyman Beecher, Henry's father. He began to mold Henry, and then Henry took off. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about Henry through his dad, Lyman.
Well, it's true, and I probably shouldn't use this high psychiatric language, but you could say it is a perfect Oedipal story. Lyman Beecher, one of the great characters in American history, he was very dogmatic in his pulpit life. He was one of the founders of what we would now call the religious right, bringing government and religion together in the time after they finally got rid of state-sponsored religion. In many ways, publicly, kind of a bigot, kind of a stiff guy. But in his private life, could not have been a more loving father, a more devoted and lovable family man. And I think it's that split between a very flexible and emotionally open personal life and a very dogmatic and powerful public life that really inspired Henry. He couldn't really rebel from his father. So all he wanted was his father's approval, and yet he couldn't really follow his path easily, even though he was forced into it. So really what happens is not that he explicitly rebels, he just takes everything and remolds it. So his father preaches God as a sort of a capricious judge, religion as a rule of law, and Jesus as almost more of a scapegoat than anything more personal, and religion as really about saving your soul from the fires of hell. Henry, he has no taste for that. He is a blithe, boisterous boy. He wants nothing to do with this Yankee Calvinism. So when he enters the ministry, he remakes it so that God is not a judge, but a loving parent, so that religion is here to make you happy on earth, not just save you from the fires of hell. And Christ, this is probably his greatest contribution. Christ really wasn't a big part of religion, American Christianity, before this. He really brings Jesus into the picture and puts him front and center and says, Jesus is not just some legal scapegoat to make up for our sins, but he is your friend, your pal, your brother, who will carry you through life and make you happier. A revolution.
He talked about the gospel of love. And it's interesting, as you're talking, it sounds as if he brings a much more personal kind of a religion here, the kind of personal religion that we've become very familiar with today, and yet there are some vast differences in terms of the way he and those who believed in him turned their use of religion and the way they saw the world.
Well, it's interesting because Henry sometimes is called a sentimentalist, much like Harriet, his sister, Uncle Tom's Cabin, and Henry's preaching, and he was a first-class preacher. That is really the best source of his fame. So you got to remember, this is before TV, before good Christian people would go to the theater. I mean, going to see preaching and going to see his public lectures was one of the first kind of mass entertainment for respectable people. So he really combined a lot of things that we think of as separate. He really combined that feeling of the heart, that what religion is about is how you feel towards God and how you feel towards others, which really was not the way you talked about it before. You would talk about you know, sin? Am I a good guy? Am I good or am I bad? He really was all for getting rid of the good-bad distinctions. But also, he was not just a heart religion fellow, he was an activist. He really said there is no good religion that is not actively working on the working towards the human good as well as the glory of God. And that's, we can get into the politics because it leads directly to the politics that he promotes. But also he was a real intellectual. He was part of the first wave of people in America in the 1830s to adopt science as their, you know, kind of their own new religion in a funny way. He loved cause and effect. He loved the scientific method of observation. He was one of the things that I've loved so much about him and is so different about him from his father is he is ecumenical. He's generous. He's liberal in the old-fashioned sense. He has no room for bigotry, no room for judgment in that harsh way. That gets him into trouble, but it also is part of his genius.
How did it get him into trouble?
Well, you know, it is the irony of writing about a long dead white Protestant minister. You'd think it would be as uncontroversial as possible, but in fact, the book is all about the three things you should never talk about in polite conversation. First, the religion, then the politics, his anti-slavery politics, but then there's sex. At the peak of his career, after the Civil War, he's a hero in the North. He is making money hand over fist. He even writes a best-selling novel. And at the exact peak of his career, he is accused of seducing his best friend's wife and one of his most pious parishioners. We all know how that kind of thing can go.
It wasn't also possibly the first relationship that he had out of wedlock.
Well, that is, you know, when I first took him on as a project, I thought, I kind of fell in love with him in the way a lot of people did back in his lifetime. He's charismatic. He's progressive. He's got a humor and a charm. But then as I was going along, I thought, oh, my golly, he's had this really big sex scandal. It was he gets accused. There's a cover-up because, of course, there's always a cover-up. And, of course, the cover-up crumbles. It, in 1872, the scandal breaks. And it turns out, well, it's not just this woman. There are perhaps other women who have been, one might say, seduced. But in the end, there's scandal. There's a trial when the cuckolded husband sues him for what he called criminal conversation. The trial lasts 6 months. I mean, this is a scandal that makes, say, the O.J. Simpson trial or the Michael Jackson trial look like small potatoes. It's where really the paparazzi were invented. But in the end, even after 6 months of testimony, the jury can't decide. This lovable man? How could he be so guilty? It's a hung jury, 9 in favor of his guilt, 3 in favor of his innocence. So I figured, I'll get the smoking gun. I'll find out for sure if it's true. Well, I was never 100% able to prove the big scandal, which we've heard about, but in digging, I dug up at least what I think are two other affairs and what is probably what they used to call a love child, an illegitimate child, with another one of his parishioners and his another best friend's wife.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. We're talking with Debbie Applegate about her book, The Most Famous Man in America. But maybe we ought to step back a little bit now.
Stay away from the sordid part.
Well, we'd love to get back to it. But tell us a little bit more. He's larger than life. Give us a picture. Give us a sense. What did he look like? What would it be like to be in the same room as him?
Ah, that's a really great question. No one's ever really put it to me like that. For one thing, let me just say it was a bundle of contradictions, which is wonderful when you're writing about someone, but also can be very frustrating. He was not a handsome man. He actually had much of the sort of, you might say, the Mick Jagger complex, a lot plumper than Mick Jagger, a round-faced fellow who got a little plumper as time went on, especially during the scandal. But he was not a conventionally handsome man, as as Mark Twain once put it, he can really, when he's in the full tide of animation, he's an awfully handsome man when he's sermonizing, but he is homely as a singed cat when he's not doing anything. But it didn't matter. He had that kind of personality. Even his, you know, sisters and brothers say he was born with that bubbly effervescence, that kind of take life easy, always feeling generous, always ready to be friendly. Not that he didn't have his dark sides, but it was that blithe, cheerful quality that just shone through in everything he did. Curious, lively, friendly, without a bone of snobbery in him, although it is true. He started off a poor preacher's kid, ended up very wealthy, and by the time he was done, he had many, many habits. He liked to carry unset jewels in his pocket so that he could take them out, you know, when he was feeling down and look at them. Well, you know, who would feel down with a pocket full of unset jewels? He was full of schemes, but not like a reformer, but more like someone who was an enthusiast. He really is the Forrest Gump of the 19th century. It's honestly true. Or Zelig, if you're a little on the older side.
He was always in the right place at the right time.
That's right. And that's how I ended up, I think, getting drawn into this project. Every time I would turn around, there's Susan B. Anthony coming by. There's General Grant. There's, you know, Emerson. I mean, there's a great story at one point where Emerson goes to see Henry preach. His church, he had one of the very first mega churches in Brooklyn Heights, still stands. Brooklyn Heights looks almost exactly as it did when he was there. And Emerson's come to see him because his daughter doesn't really care for Emerson's writings, but loves Henry. And while he's there, General Grant is there. And then there's a great story. Emerson's as starstruck by seeing General Grant, or President Grant, as anyone. I mean, you don't really get to see those private sides. And that's one of the great things about his story. Whatever hot topic is going on, whether it's the Civil War or whether women should wear bloomers, there he is.
You mentioned his church, the Plymouth Church. Is that it? Tell us about that. I think that gives a little bit of insight into his character.
He was one of the, I mean, he literally had a mega church in the way that we think of them now. 3,000 people every Sunday. And a real, in many ways, some people criticized it as a cult of personality. He didn't have a lot of time of day for other kinds of ecclesiastical duties or ties. He liked to be free. And he preached a very free gospel of love, often contradicting himself. But it didn't really matter if he was always logical or coherent because he was a firecracker on stage. And in fact, his church, very unusually, is built like a stage with kind of a platform that comes out. He didn't want a pulpit to get in between him and the rest of the crowd. He was, frankly, would have been an actor, I think, if he were born today. He had all of the great traits of that. In his own mind, I think he thought he should have been a politician.
There's a really wonderful story that you tell in the book of something that happens in his church, in the Plymouth Church, when he brings in a young girl, a young slave girl, and he fires up the crowd to rescue her. Why didn't you tell us that story?
Well, it really, I think, captures the essence of Beecher in a million different ways. You know, this is it's hard to picture nowadays what it was like to be on the eve of the Civil War. Just that kind of hatred, that kind of tension, the idea that the country was not, you know, really was in danger of bursting apart. And what Henry did, he had nothing really to offer as a political solution. I had a lot of political advice, but he was not a senator. He was not going to solve the actual slavery problem, but like his sister Harriet, what he said was, I can change the way people feel, which is really what Uncle Tom's Cabin did, and that's what his speeches, his preaching, and his writing did. Realizing that changing the way people feel is the first step to changing laws and changing policies. So he would do things, instead of writing treatises, he would have stunts, very emotional stunts. And one of his most famous is, he brought up a couple times young, beautiful, light-skinned slave girls from the South to be sold, who were going to be sold at auction, going downriver. But instead, he would bring them into the church, bring them up on that big platform, and pretend to be an auctioneer, mimicking an auctioneer auctioning this young girl to slavery, or in this case, to freedom. Literally whipping up the congregation until they are sending, they're throwing money into the collection baskets, they're taking off their jewelry to pay for their freedom. I mean, literally sobbing, hysterical, happens a couple times. I mean, and of course people are outraged. You're in the church, and not only that, selling someone, because literally they were buying her freedom. And yet, at a time when people really didn't care that much about slavery in the North, there are a lot of people who, you know, if it weren't for the Civil War, they would have been fine to leave the slaves where they were. It changed a lot of people's minds to be asked to imagine if this is your daughter. What if this were your daughter up here about to be sold into a life of beating and rape and labor? Huge, huge impact. Same thing with he sends rifles. Boxes of rifles and Bibles out to the settlers out in Kansas who are fighting the pro-slavery forces. They're the anti-slavery settlers. It is, like many people think of them as terrorists. So imagine the country's most prominent minister sending the equivalent of AK-47s, high-repeating, high-tech rifles to, you know, terrorists. It really quite something. It's hard to picture even now.
And we're talking with Debbie Applegate about The Most Famous Man in America, her biography of Henry Ward Beecher.
And yet, Debbie Applegate, he many times had one foot in the abolition movement and one foot still outside of that circle. He had a hard time putting his whole self behind the freeing of the slaves and the changing of the laws and...
Nobody really has asked me that question, and yet it's so central to who he is. I mean, that's one of the contradictions that absolutely drove me insane, because sometimes he would be very bold, and then other times he would step back very quickly, and especially on politics, but it was true in his personal life, it was true in his preaching, and I think it's because of the nature of being such a brilliant speaker and a bit of a hothead. He would get so worked up in the moment with the audience that he would, and he never worked from notes, he always spoke off the top of his head with a basic outline, that he would end up saying things that often he believed in the moment, but couldn't really totally justify in the latter, you know, when the Fuhrer had burned down a little bit. And I think he often wanted things to be better than he could see them. I could see the path to get there. You could see the end of slavery, but he oftentimes wanted to shy away from the things that might go along with it, like the idea of a slave rebellion. Oh, well, that's no good. Well, why not? Well, he couldn't quite say. He just didn't sound like a good idea.
Even though he could send rifles to the Kansas, to the whites there.
Exactly.
But on the other hand, too, you said before he was like the Bill Clinton of his time. And it seems to me, you know, he wanted to be loved.
That's right.
And so that's a very hard position to be in. That's a very hard place to take positions from.
Well, you know, it's funny. Despite the fact that I felt like this book was going to be, and I structured it very much, a little like a psychological thriller. And very much around that kind of psychological question. What happens when you are dying for love and it leads you to greatness, but it also leads you to the brink or sometimes over the brink of excess? And in particular, on all kinds of scores, but especially on the adultery question. Well, in the end, I mean, I took 7 years to write this book. I wrote about it for my dissertation before that and my senior thesis before that. You would think that after all that, I would absolutely have an opinion about why someone would be a chronic adulterer. And in the end, as I was writing the very last page, at the very end of my deadline, I realized in the end, it was as much a mystery to me why he would consider throwing away his career for a sexual peccadillo as it was when I started.
And why?
Well, in the end, my editor says, well, you can't just throw up your hands and not say, you know, I have to say something. So I really, really pushed and thought about it. And here's what I finally came to, is I think there are two different kinds of great people, or let's say great men in particular. I haven't made as much of a study of great women, so I suspect they're different. There are some great men, say like William Lloyd Garrison, another abolitionist, or maybe a Ralph Nader would be a good modern example, who are, I feel, driven like a bayonet from the back by their principles. They are so outraged, they are so angry that they have to do something, even if they would not necessarily be inclined to do something. And they thus find themselves on the path to greatness. Then there are the others, and Beecher certainly is one of them, and I don't mean to make an invidious comparison, but I think Bill Clinton might be one of them. Those people, they're not driven from the back, they are drawn to the light. They want the approval, they want the love, the attention that comes from accomplishment, and that leads them on the path to greatness. The problem is those people are more lovable than, say, the Ralph Naders of the world, but that also gets you into trouble because you start getting treated like a rock star, and you want all that love. It's very easy to forget the rules apply to you the same way.
Right. There's something I just have to ask you about, mostly because of where we are. And that is, I had never known that he had a very special connection to Amherst. He went to high school here, basically, and he went to college. He went to Amherst College. Tell us a little bit about what Amherst College was like. I mean, at that time, it was really in the vanguard.
That is certainly true. On the other hand, it was also considered a priest factory. As some people said, it was founded to turn out congregational ministers to fight what they called the Unitarian menace spreading from Boston. So his father sent him to Amherst because it was a tiny little newfound college. He thought he would be safer here than at Yale, where they, you know, much more rowdy. But in many ways, it actually wasn't that different. It is true Amherst does not turn out as many ministers as it used to, but they both, now and then, have a very brainy, bookish quality. It's a Henry loved college and lived it up. He did not get very good grades. He spent a lot of time socializing, reading what he wanted. But it had that intense atmosphere of a bunch of people who came here because what they liked is ideas and books. He discovers the Romantic movement coming from Europe, which hugely influences him. The idea of being, more about feeling than thought. The idea of being anti-tradition. All those have a huge influence on him. But also, he discovers science here, and that really shapes his thinking. He becomes a real rational thinker as well as an emotional thinker. It's also important to point out that Amherst, if you're from here, you won't find this too surprising. A lot of small towns, these little Yankee small towns back then, maybe even now, were very closed-minded, very closed little places. Amherst was really saved from that by its passion for higher education that continues now. There are still colleges everywhere and universities everywhere you look, including where we are right now. One of the fun things about the book is it's really a geographical journey, starting in Connecticut and Massachusetts and going to Ohio and Indiana, and then into New York, where, of course, he bursts into fame. And one of the really fun things is in the East, Brooklyn Heights, Litchfield, Connecticut, the north end of Boston, and Amherst all look very, very similar to when he was there. You can really walk around, and if you squint, you can really see what it was like.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Debbie Applegate about Henry Ward Beecher, the most famous man in America. Stay tuned for more of our interview after the break.
All you true friends of the nation, attend to humanity's call. Come aid in the slaves' liberation and roll on the Liberty Ball. And roll on the Liberty Ball. And roll on the Liberty Ball. Come aid in the slaves' liberation and roll on the Liberty Ball. We'll finish the temple of freedom and make it capacious within. All who seek shelter may find it, whatever the hue of their skin. Whatever the hue of their skin. Whatever the hue of their skin. And all who seek shelter may find it, whatever the hue of their skin. Success to the old-fashioned doctrine that men are created all free. down with the power of the despot, wherever his stronghold may be.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. We're talking with Debbie Applegate about her biography of Henry Ward Beecher. It's called The Most Famous Man in America. So you said reason and the heart.
Passion, and too. You're right.
Reason
That's
and passion.
That's a very nice way to put it.
And, you know, what strikes me is that that is a kind of melding that he did successfully that we've really gotten away from in a way. You know, when you think of modern-day religion, reason is denigrated. And on the other hand, there are others, people in the New Age movement, who would say that who would criticize people who are over-rationalist, mm-hmm. who are not enough sympathetic to the intuition. So I wonder, talk about that marriage of reason and passion.
And I would also throw in activism, because the idea that you have to act on your beliefs in a way that it's not just about saving your soul, but being your brother's keeper.
Is it a more human way of being?
Well, first of all, I would say that is what Henry really brought to the table. He had brought a very realistic understanding of human nature that really came from his time at Amherst, that combination of science and romantic thinking. Talked about psychology for the first time. And he insisted, people are not just all good or all bad, all saints, all sinners. People always have mixed motives. He didn't even have a time of day for the idea of original sin. As he put it, there's too much sin going on now for me to look back to Adam and Eve. And that made him both a little wiser, you know, not overly idealistic, but at the same time optimistic, but also a little more forgiving. You know, everyone has foibles. Now, it is also what I think led him to cut corners, and that certainly was something that was said about him, and that's how he ends up getting to the idea of that he can have affairs. I think his theology, that gospel of love, that idea, he gives up the idea of hell. He gives up the idea of sin as we know it. Sin in his scheme is not... it's not a crime against God's law or a breaking of God's law. It's a stain on your character. It's a way of suffering. And why should you go to hell? Because that you don't need the extra punishment. It feels so bad to sin anyway. You feel so guilty. And that is a slippery slope. And yet, I would say, you know, that question of the heart and the reason, I think that's the reason the scandal really mattered. He was essentially the public face of what we would call liberal evangelicalism, that liberal evangelical Christianity that was a real movement in the 19th century. That movement almost gets stopped in its tracks by that scandal, because all of a sudden these more liberal views of Christian life start to look like, oh no, they're not a way to heaven. They look like they're a slippery slope down into lust. And that really sets back exactly that movement, that combination of rationality and passion that you first brought up. I mean, it literally stops it dead, and it makes it more intellectual. You get the social gospelers, but they're all New York intellectual. They're not all, I shouldn't say that. But that's how they get perceived, as elite. And the more populist religion ends up going in a more conservative evangelical way. So now you go to church, you'll still hear the fire and brimstone. But what's fascinating is you'll also hear the Jesus is your lover, Jesus is your best friend. And that's the funny legacy of him. I should also add, I think the scandal also really, it didn't stop dead, but it set back the women's movement by about 20 years, I'd say. Well, poor Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and all those women activists were deeply embedded, accidentally embedded, I'm afraid, in the sex scandal. They were friends with all the participants. They even heard one night of passionate confessions from the alleged adulteress. When the news broke, it seemed like, once again, those women who are trying to get the vote, what they're really trying to do is destroy the American family and bring free love to everything. And, you know, all you need is a little bit of sex scandal to set back a progressive movement. It doesn't take much.
Well, I was often stopped in my tracks thinking of Henry Ward Beecher and then thinking of what was going on today with religion and politics and the evangelical movement and born-again Christian, and so many comparisons that I see, comparisons of lust.
Yes,
within prominent people within the politics and religion, and again the mixing of religion and politics, religion in the White House, we're beginning to see. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, it's funny. It took me 7 years to write this book. And when I first sold it, now about 8 years ago, 8.5 years ago, it was during the Lewinsky scandal. And I actually got a great deal because everyone thought, oh, this is going to be, you know, it's going to be perfect. It was a 1.5-year contract, which obviously I missed my deadline. and it was, so it was all, you know, that's why they bought it. It was going to come out in time for that to be the connection. Well, by about 3 or 4, we're moving into the Bush administration. It's obvious I've missed my chance. I was feeling quite bummed out. But then by the time I actually finished, you know, you wait long enough, the scandals will come around again. And in this, I think they're actually more relevant because a critical part of the story, and this is one of the things that was hard to write, is it's all upward in some ways until after the Civil War. Because there's ugly things. There's a lot of race riots. There's terrible violence, bigotry. But you know that the war is going to come, that slavery will end, that Henry will be famous. It's only in the Reconstruction period where all of a sudden all those good intentions, the Republican Party goes from being the party of moral reform and really a pretty noble enterprise in many ways to becoming the party of big business, of entrenched power.
Yeah, could you actually say something about that? Because I think most of us think of the Republican Party as the latter. Talk about the roots of it.
Well, and that's one of the great things. Henry is very involved in the early Republican Party. The early Republican Party is one of the only parties, it's certainly the only successful party in American culture to begin around one issue, which is slavery. And the idea that the Republicans were the racially progressive party is really, I think, very surprising. They're also very pro-education, pro all the things that we would think of almost as New Deal-like now. And that's what actually coalesces that group. And then they get power. And, you know, as we know, it's true of the Democrats then and true of the Democrats now, is that same as Republicans, is any time you have 15 years, say, of entrenched power, which is what you're starting to look at by the end, by the time it all starts to go to pieces, it doesn't matter where you started, you are going to have let the worst than the most corrupt people rise when you have such unchecked power. That would be my first thing to say. But it is also true that the Republicans, they went that way also on their own hook. They are indeed the party of big business by the 1870s. They are beginning to repudiate a lot of the principles they first stood for because, that was an experiment. And what's sad is, but also great as a writer, is as the scandals start to mount up, the Republican Party government scandals start to mount up after the Civil War, that's what triggers the whole sex scandal stuff.
Is that like the Teapot Dome scandal?
A lot of the Grant administration, Credit Mobilier, a lot of the Tweed rings, all of those, the whiskey rings, all of these, there's just quite not enough regulation for an economy that is just racing well beyond our ability to regulate it. Exactly. Teapot Dome's a little later, but all of those scandals come up around then. And the Republican Party's starting to split. Well, same thing's happening religiously. The old orthodoxy's starting to go. Modern ideas are really kind of starting to come in. And that also affects the sex. It turns out he starts arguing with his best friend over the presidential race and over Republican policies. His best friend starts to split with him over his, he doesn't want to kowtow to the more conservative Christians.
Is this Tilton?
Yes, that's right. I mean, one of the cuckolded husbands, the most famous of them. And in the end, I'm pretty sure Henry seduces Tilton's wife in part to get back at him for clobbering him in the press politically. And frankly, Tilton's probably clobbering him in the press because his wife is really mad that he's leaving the church and she has such a crush on Henry. I'm telling it all as a cluster of crazy facts, but as a historian, you don't find that combination, as I say, sex, politics, religion, all actually working together, so that when the time the book actually came out, to talk about that question of religion and politics and scandal, it was a perfect time. Because, you know, as we all know, it's not just that the Republicans have been in power so long, it's also that the religious right has been basically the power behind the throne. And that's not an easy position to be in. Americans are very forgiving, but they do not forgive hypocrisy very easily.
Well, we are talking with Debbie Applegate, the author of The Most Famous Man in America, which is a biography of Henry Ward Beecher. As a historian, you sure chose a good foil, so to speak, for your work.
Ugh, I had no idea. If I had known when I signed that contract, I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have done it. It goes from 1775 to 1887, if we start with his parents. And I had no idea what I did not know about American history.
Well, this was actually the question I was going to ask. I think you do a masterful job of covering so much. How did you keep it in such a way that, I mean, you go pretty deeply into the development of the Republican Party, into the anti-slavery movement, into what was going on with the territories. We even learn a lot about the Great Awakening, the Transcendentalists, and because we haven't even really talked about that, the connection between Emerson and Beecher. How were you able to kind of bring all this wide sweep in? And what were some of the things that, you know, the challenges for you in doing that?
Well, the biggest challenge is making yourself sit still for 8 to 10 hours a day. I am not kidding. Half of writing is keeping your bottom in the chair. And because, boy, is it easy to get up and be distracted. But the other thing is, I should not say this. This is not very kosher nowadays. But about midway through, I realized I didn't really know how to do what you're describing, how to tell his personal plot, which was very exciting, and how it intersected with the big historical stories. And as you can tell, he intersects over and over again. It's almost like he's psychic to know where the next hotspot's going to be. So I stopped researching, I stopped writing, and I did about a 6-month self-apprenticeship program. And I've read a ton of books on how to write thrillers, how to write mysteries, how to write novels. I did a book called The Artist Way, which is this long series of exercises. And I did the exercises. I followed the books. I taught myself how to write as if I were writing a thriller. And what's funny is this book, I followed all the rules, like even the ones that seemed crazy, like I don't remember reading one that said, if you want it to feel foreboding, have it be raining. And I thought, well, that's ridiculous. And then the next book I was reading, I was like, oh, I'm very nervous. What's going to happen? Well, it was pouring. Now, I didn't make anything up. Even on something like the weather, I would check the day after, not the weather prediction, to make sure, because I was terrified of being caught up, you know. But once I kind of knew how to do it, I used all the rules. Even one of the more helpful things was I read a little thing about how to write pornography. Because, you know, as a writer, it seems to me that in the end, you only really have one goal, and that is to get people to turn the page. And the only way to get them to turn the page is if you are actually physically affecting them with your ink and your paper, which is an alchemy, I think, that any reader knows is magical. But when you're a writer, you have to learn the tricks, which was not easy because I thought it was magic. And so, like, the pornography, you know, what is a better example of pen and ink creating physical responses? So it said things like, well, the way to write to get the biggest effect is you describe something very visually with all the senses. What does it smell like? What does it taste like? What does it, you know, look like? And their example was Elvira was standing there naked. So then the next step is to endow that vision, that image, with feeling. And their example is Elvira was standing there naked feeling vulnerable. And then you move to the action. Now, that sounds formulaic, and of course you break it up, but every once in a while I would stop and say, in this paragraph, what is the vision? What is physically happening here? Even if it's an idea, physically, where is this idea settled? Who feels something about it? What do they feel? And then why does it matter?
And how could you do that about people you didn't know and this not isn't that fiction?
Well, I'll tell you one thing about the Beechers. This was both a blessing and a curse. There were dozens of kids, millions of articles and newspaper, you name it, letters, diaries, not just written by them, about them. I am certain I did not see all of them because they number in the tens of thousands. So that blessing was they were always writing autobiographical stories and memoirs. So I had a lot of that information. The curse was I had all that information. That's a big part of why it took 7 years.
And, you know, I've never asked this of somebody before, but I've always wondered about it. And this is a perfect opportunity to ask, how did you keep all of that straight? Can you say something maybe about how you organized things so that when you wanted to find something, you needed the reference, you knew where to get it?
Oh, that's one of the things when I give advice to writers. I say, you know, you think, oh, I'll remember, you know, but you will not if it's a long project. So from the beginning, I really started with good habits and quickly realized there was no way to organize the notes except chronologically. So I have a 1,300-page chronology of Henry's life, and that doesn't even begin to count everything. Some of it almost day by day, and of course with some big gaps as well. And that really makes a big difference because then ideas, you know, turn out to, in history, they fall into their different places, and it made it a lot. Time is one way. I also am a huge outliner, enough so that when I had to rewrite an introduction, and we all know, if you read things, the last chapter, never the one that sells the book. It's the first chapter, and it may be the only thing people read. So I thought, oh, okay, a lot of pressure on that first chapter. How do I do that? This was, you know, pretty late in the game, so I thought, I'll go to the two big bestsellers at the time and see what they did. Seabiscuit, the book about the horse, and Fast Food Nation. Very different kinds of books, but they were the two nonfiction bestsellers. I went and I did an outline of each of their introductions. How paragraph one introduces the character, paragraph two, backstory, paragraph three, action. They are identical. Those two books, very different topics, different formats, different approaches, totally identical in structure. So mine is identical to theirs in structure. If you outline them, they are almost exactly alike.
Well, the book is The Most Famous Man in America, the biography of Henry Ward Beecher, and we have been talking with the author, Debbie Applegate. Thanks so much for coming on to our show here.
Thank you. And if I might, I know sometimes people want more information. There's actually a little website. I'm sure if Henry were around now, he'd have his own talk show, but at least he has a website, and it is www.themostfamousmaninamerica.com or www.henrywardbeecher.com. Lots more about him and the book.
That's great. And you can go to our website at writersvoice.net, and we will link to those websites. And that was Debbie Applegate talking to us here at Writer's Voice about Henry Ward Beecher. Michael Pollitt joined me on that interview. And speaking of Henry Ward Beecher, here's an excerpt from an interview I did with Marge Piercy in 2005 about her novel of the same period in American history, Sex Wars. It chronicles the rise of the first American feminist movement, and the characters include such early feminists as Susan B. Anthony and Victoria Woodhull. They moved in the same circles as Henry Ward Beecher and knew him well. And now these guys, these Americans of the Victorian age, I have to say, were a pretty raunchy lot.
They were indeed, our notion of the Victorians. Now, it's true that there were a lot of straight-laced Victorians. Who referred to piano limbs rather than legs and so forth. But there was also a tremendous sexual, not particularly underground. There were a lot of churches. There were also a lot of brothels. There were at least as many brothels as churches. There was this whole sporting life phenomenon of the young men who came to the cities and who had their newspapers and their whole world of glamorizing prostitution, gambling, running articles about their favorite whorehouses, the world of illegal boxing, terriers, rat catching, dog fights, cock fights, all of that, gambling, drinking, you know. So this was a whole huge thing, and pornography was an enormous industry then, as it is now. It was very common. You walk into most bookstores then, you would see pornography openly displayed.
In most bookstores?
Yes.
You also talk about a fascinating character who, I have to say, was new to me, and that's Victoria Woodhull.
Victoria Woodhull was the free love feminist, so a lot of feminists haven't wanted particularly to claim her. But she was an extremely intelligent woman. I've read her speeches and her writings. She and her sister came out of utter poverty. They came to New York, and they succeeded in snaring Cornelius Vanderbilt, the richest man in the United States, as their sponsor. They were the first women stockbrokers. They made their own money. They started a newspaper that was quite successful and very radical. It was the first thing to publish Marx in the United States.
Really?
Yeah, the Communist Manifesto was published in it. It was the first translation in English in the States. She ran for president. She was a very interesting woman. She came out of the background of being a medium, you know, putting contact with the spirits. That was big at that time for several reasons. First of all, as opposed to Helen Fire Brimstone, of the sort that one of the other characters, Anthony Comstock, whom I'll get to in a minute, loved, the spiritual movement was much more positive. Now, women had generally lost about half their children in childhood. Infant mortality and childhood mortality was extremely high. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Cady Stanton was very unusual in that she had 7 children and lost none of them. Her mother had lost half of her children. That was common. And also the Civil War had killed an enormous number of young men. So every family had a lot of mortality in it. And the spiritualism offered them a way of contacting these people and a whole theory of how the next life was better, and they were moving on, and they were on a different plane of existence, and, you know, were progressing and happy and so forth, but still interested in them. So it was very comforting to men and women, but especially women, at a time when there was so much death in every family.
I see. And you also had, well, among the progressives of their era, that is the folks who were part of the abolition movement and the women's movement, including men, I mean, there was an awful lot of, you know, shall we say, extramarital sex going on?
Yes. There was a lot of passionate affinities.
Is that what they were called?
That's one of the things they were called, yes.
That's a lovely term.
It was our notion of what the initial wave of the women's movement and the abolitionist movement, because they started, you know, there was a lot of crossbreeding between them, and people were active in both of them. You know, we think of Susan B. Anthony.
Yeah.
But there were an awful lot of women in it who were, and men who were quite, well, they had a wandering eye. They had passionate affinities outside their marriage. They had affairs. They had, you know, they were not very straight-laced in their private lives. Now, they may or may not, a lot of this was quite secret, but everybody knew about it. It was secret but known about at the same time.
And there was some scandal with Henry Ward, who...
Yes. Harriet Beecher Stowe's brother, Henry Ward Beecher, was the most... He was like the most important televangelist of nowadays. He was the preeminent Protestant preacher in the whole United States. There was a whole industry built around him. He recommended soaps, he recommended liniments and so forth, and he was published books, which he largely didn't write. And he was the gospel of love.
I see.
Which he practiced with a number of his female practitioners, his female congregation.
With great gusto.
Yes. The trouble is, he had an affair with the wife of his ghostwriter. Theo Tilton. He had an affair with him. When Theo found out about it, though he was having affairs and passionate affinities, it was not right for his wife to, and he absolutely blew up.
And actually had an affair with Victoria Woodhull.
Yes.
Right, so the circle closes there.
Oh, yes. All the circles close. Everybody mm-hmm. has to do with everybody before the novel is over.
Right, including Comstock, who got involved in this as well.
Yes.
So I want to go back, though, to this point that you made about Henry Ward Beecher being the televangelist of his age, because that brings up another, actually a contrast, and that is how religion played not only a repressive role, as in the case of the figure of Comstock, Anthony Comstock, but also played a very progressive role. Evangelism played a very progressive role at that time.
Not necessarily evangelism. The spiritual movement was very progressive. And he was sort of moving in that the gospel of love was his, you know, his invention.
But wasn't the abolition movement kind of connected with the evangelist movement as
well?
Yeah,
and also with spiritualism.
The novel is Sex Wars, a novel of the turbulent post-Civil War period, and is by Marge Piercy. And thank you so much, Marge Piercy, for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you for having me on your program.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice, airing on this station and podcasting on the web at writersvoice.net. Please join us next week when we talk about the history of tea with Beatrice Hohenegger. Her book is Liquid Jade. Also, we hear from nature writer Robert Finch about his collection of essays, The Iambics of Newfoundland, Notes from an Unknown Shore. To learn more about the show, visit our website at writersvoice.net. You can catch our podcast there and listen at your leisure. Please send your thoughts, comments, and questions to write@writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.